Today at Reader's Corner, an interview from our archives with Bethine Church, author of a memoir, A Lifelong Affair, My Passion for People and Politics.
I feel that the most important thing you can do as a citizen is be informed, and if you don't like what the government's doing, try to correct them. I had an uncle who was a governor. I had a cousin who was both a House member and a senator. I guess I grew up with a political spoon in my mouth. I came back here with the idea that I would write this book, but I really didn't know how to write it till I had dinner with various friends, and they said, "You tell such wonderful stories. Why don't you write them down?"
I'm Bob Kustra, president of Boise State University. Welcome to Reader's Corner. This Valentine's Day weekend, we're featuring a special edition of an interview with one of Idaho's sweethearts, Bethine Church, widow of Idaho Senator Frank Church and a political powerhouse in her own right. Bethine's contributions to her state and to institutions, including Boise State, will be remembered for many years to come. Bethine Church would have turned 91 this coming Wednesday. She died a few days before Christmas on December 21st, 2013, at her home in Boise. It was at her memorial service last weekend that my wife Kathy and I thought it appropriate to run this encore of my interview with Bethine. I've had the great honor and privilege of spending considerable time with Bethine on numerous occasions over the past decade, including as part of her work as founder and chair of the Frank Church Institute at Boise State. I first met her in this recording booth shortly after we launched this weekly radio show back in 2003. That day I spoke with Bethine about her new memoir, A Lifelong Affair, My Passion for People and Politics. The book is a fascinating account of Frank and Bethine Church's many years in Washington as part of the political elite, and about their efforts on behalf of progressive issues such as civil rights, opposition to the Vietnam War, and wilderness preservation. Besides being the tale of a political woman, A Lifelong Affair is a poignant love story that offers insights into the steadfast relationship between two strong-willed and dynamic personalities. Bethine Church's sharp wit, her warmth, and boundless energy shine through in this interview from our archives, and I'm pleased we are able to feature it today. I began our conversation by welcoming Bethine to our program, and we'll pick up the interview from there. Bethine Church, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Oh, thank you. I'm so glad you're the president here.
Well, thank you.
And I love working with BSU, and I'm so glad to finally meet you. We've been playing touch tag ever since you came.
That's right. Well, I think the most important thing I missed since I've been here was the Frank Church Institute's presentation this year. It was a board meeting, and I had to be at the Idaho Board of Education meeting. And I even missed that. You had David Broder here, I believe.
Yes, and we had Vice President Mondale.
That's right.
And we talked about a number of people who had served on the church committee on secrecy and on the institutions of the CIA and the FBI. And it was really fabulous. I loved it, and I loved doing it with the Andrus Center and with the Statesman. It was really great.
Well, you know, since you brought up the CIA, let's start there.
Okay.
Frank Church was a senator who wasn't afraid to take on the tough issues. And one of the issues that he took on in the course of his years in the Senate was the question of whether or not the CIA and the FBI, in their diligence, sometimes went over the line. And he explored this often, but what I found particularly interesting is that after the senator died, someone called up the Boise State Library asking for all of the church papers. And apparently, you feel, according to what I've read, that it might have been Reagan's CIA director, William Casey. And I wonder if you could tell our listeners a little bit about that very minor episode in your life, but nonetheless one very important when it comes to our country.
It was very major because none of his papers would have survived. And as everyone who uses it, everyone at the Special Collections say that it's Alan Vertis says, and Mary, they both say they're invaluable and students use them. But a man named Garfunkel was chosen by President Reagan to set up a separate investigative branch for the White House. Of course, the person who wanted them was the head of the CIA, and I pulled out all the stops. The Boise State Librarian pulled all the stops out, and we found out from the historian of the Senate that no one had ever encroached on the two branches of government to ask for a senator's papers from the White House. And Pat Leahy, who was on the committee, and Senator Durenberg backed me up. So did Birch Bayh, who is a senator who was on the committee. And all Frank wanted to do in those hearings, and he got out the full record of it, all he wanted to do was have them act the way they should act, not do intrusive things to American citizens, not to try to assassinate presidents abroad. The CIA did a good deal of the tries to do that, and sometimes they succeeded, as they did in Africa, as they did in almost in Cuba, and as they did in Chile. So all he wanted them to do was act within their mandate.
Well, you know, here you are. I listen to you give this answer, such a knowledgeable, informed answer, years and years after the event. And I must say that I can only imagine how valuable you must have been to Frank Church during his years in public service. And I would also add that I suspect that it was a somewhat unusual level of expertise that you brought to his side as his partner compared to most spouses whose husbands or wives decide to get into politics. Now, that must have something to do with your upbringing here in Idaho and the fact that you grew up in this business. Tell me about your father, Pop, as you call him in the book.
Pop was the governor of Idaho. He was the mayor of Idaho Falls. He'd been a legislator from Custer County and from Bonneville County. He was a twinkly, storytelling, wonderful kind of guy, and he became a federal judge. He was the last appointee of Roosevelt. As he often said, I fortunately lost my reelection as governor. And I had an uncle who was a governor, Brazilla Clark. I had a cousin who was both a House member and a senator, D. Worth Clark. And I guess I grew up with a political spoon in my mouth. I asked them to boat for my daddy, and I wondered why in the world he wanted a boat when we weren't near any water. And then I spent the rest of my life asking for votes for all sorts of people.
Well, that's a wonderful story. And, of course, it leads me to remember a piece in the book where I believe your husband, after one of his first elections, really turned to some reporters and said, if you want to give credit to this election victory, you have to give credit to Bethine, who took me around this state and introduced me to it in a way that very few people have had a chance to learn Idaho.
I was very lucky. I traveled with my dad a lot. And the nice part of our relationship, I have to say, came from both Pop and Frank. They both thought that women were important partners. My mother didn't like politics, but she was a partner with Pop all the time. Ran the ranch, could cut up a steer. My husband told every staffer he had that if I needed to know when a hearing was or when to go in the gallery if there was a big debate, they should let me know and help me find the information I needed, because I would go out to Idaho and speak for him. And, you know, it takes a senator to facilitate a wife to have that much impact. You don't do it alone.
Right.
You often make enemies. Instead, every staffer Frank had to this day are my personal friends. They're just wonderful.
Well, that's exactly what I mean. You're unusual as a spouse of a candidate and an office holder in that you were able to step in and do those things. I sense in reading your book, in a number of different areas of the book, issues that you address in the book, that you may have been the more cautious of the couple, perhaps the more even conservative of the couple. Frank Church was a very principled man. He wasn't afraid to rushing headlong into an issue when he knew he was right. And just from reading carefully, I sensed that Bethine Church is the wife who was there at the end of the day to kind of pull him in every now and then and get his feet back on the ground so he didn't get in too much trouble. How far right or wrong am I?
It's sort of in between. Actually, I probably was the, shall I say, liberal? That isn't a good word anymore. But if you look it up in a dictionary, it's a very nice word. But he couldn't convince me that Peacemakers did a very good job because I'd watched Peacemakers over the years lose elections. And I was just cautious when he started to be against the war in Vietnam. But after 3 months, he convinced me he was absolutely right. And then I was as gung-ho as anybody.
Well, one of the quotes that I took down, and I took down a number of quotes that I hope I have time to share with our listeners because I think they tell a long story about some of the famous issues you've had to deal with in your career. But one was, we're not going to have Vietnam for dinner, are we, Bethine?
We're not having Vietnam for dinner anymore, are we, Bethine? And he really said that. I guess he realized that I've finally come around. And, you know, I came back here with the idea that I would write this book, but I really didn't know how to write it till I had dinner with various friends. And they said, you tell such wonderful stories. Why don't you write them down? And if Dan Williams and my youngest son, Chase, had not insisted that I put it on tape recorder, there still wouldn't be a book. And, you know, I appreciate that. The other thing I came back to do was make the church chair the first endowed chair at BSU. And now it's the Frank Church Institute, and we're spreading out for funding for scholarships and in public affairs, history, all the things Frank cared about most. We've got a professor for last year, and we hope to have a Frank Church professor for this year. I'm just feeling good. And then I worked on the challenges to the Sawtooth Recreation Area. So I guess the thing to tell you is that I thought I might just fold up when Frank died. But then I found out that I had too much passion for things, and I couldn't.
You're listening to an interview from our archives with Bethine Church about her memoir, A Lifelong Affair, My Passion for People in Politics. Bethine died on December 21st, 2013. Well, you certainly have done wonderful work here for Boise State University and for our students and our faculty, and the Institute is only one example, but then, of course, the contributions you're making to the Sawtooths. We can't say enough for how much we appreciate what you've done. And again, when I read this book and see these quotes that are verbatim, the way they were spoken so many years ago, I must say that your friends and your sons who told you to take this down and tape it, thank goodness that you listened to them, because we all get the benefit from this now. One of your other famous quotes in there, and you quoted Lyndon Johnson, and I want you in a second here to give us your impressions of Lyndon Johnson, because of course we all have over the years our own, but here's the quote: the next time you want a dam, ask Walter Lippmann for it.
Yes.
Now tell us about what that means.
He actually never said it till the next morning, and he wished he'd said it, so he said to a Time magazine correspondent, this is what I said to Senator Church when he was against me on the Vietnam thing. And, of course, he hadn't said it at all. And two senators standing right in front of me with Frank corroborated it. And you know what the reporter from Time said? He said, Senator, you've been so good to me. I have to tell you, I'm so sorry. But it's going to be quoted just like Lyndon said it, because my editor said it's too good a story. And, you know, it's still told in Washington in the apocryphal way.
And apparently the substance behind the quote was the fact that Senator Church was pointing out to Lyndon Johnson that he really ought to read some of Walter Lippmann's recent columns, who was pointing out the problems of getting engaged in these wars like Vietnam, the way the French did before
and
us.
Dien Bien Phu, yeah.
Right, and of course, Lyndon came back with the quote, the next time you want a dam, ask Walter Lippmann for it.
I mean, and, you know, Lyndon, I never could be mad at him when I was with him. He was always a big wonderful Texan. But he, Frank always said it's a darn shame. He has a great society. He's got a great plan as a president. And Vietnam is his Alamo.
Tell me about, you said you decided to write the book. And again, it's a 2003 copyright. How long did it take you to put together this vast collection of stories and anecdotes?
I must have talked into a tape recorder every Monday night with Dan Williams every time we could get around to it for over a year. Mm-hmm. And then he got a young lady to type it up. And then he, because I am not good with typing, put it on computer. And he said the most valuable thing he did for me was keep me from using wonderful in every other sentence. and you know, it's really great. And Chase, believe it or not, would cook our dinner while we'd put it on computer. And we had to look for synonyms for certain things. But then I got a publisher that was a small publisher who does only about four either biographies, autobiographies, or, you know, histories of people a year. And he liked the book. And he got me a very good editor who didn't change my voice in it. You know, Pop told stories all those times at the dinner table. There wasn't TV dinner table conversation. There was real conversation. And so I wanted to tell some of Pop's stories and about the pioneer days in Idaho and about running for political office and about the people I'd met. I flew into the first fortified village in Vietnam in a helicopter and looked out and I thought, they can't clear that jungle.
Amazing.
So, you know, it's a kaleidoscope of everything I remembered. And since I didn't have diaries, I thought I better do it while my brain was working.
Well, it certainly sounds like you have had diaries because it's written so well and there's such great memories. Let's talk about the 1976 presidential race. Talk to us about the senator's chances in that race at the beginning, how you saw it stacking up. And by the time you finish this, I'd like you to tell us about the Idaho Peanuts. That's a great story.
Well, the fun part of the whole thing was that he really had a large committee who wanted him to run. And he had them in a small office at the Senate the day that Mansfield said there were going to be these select committee hearings on the CIA and the FBI. And Frank felt so strongly about that, he said to Mike, I want to be the chair of it. And Mike said, I understand you're going to run for the presidency, Frank. It's going to be too late. If you do it, you have to promise me you won't run until the reports are out. And Frank promised, and he always kept his promise. And, of course, that made it too late. But we had a late strategy. We were going to run and win as many primaries as we could. Then they didn't start out with the huge bang they do now. There were New York and all sorts of places. Then there was the Nebraska primary. And we won by 1% in Nebraska. And then we were ready to go on to Portland and Oregon, and suddenly Jerry Brown got in it. And our big chance of having a tied-up convention was to win California. So we were all through by then, although we went on and won the only primaries that were won against Carter, the four major primaries. We won Nebraska, Oregon and Montana, and a number of caucuses. But, you know, we had the most fun. And Frank said, I'm glad I ran, even though we didn't, you know, make it to the presidency, because I now know more about this country than I will ever know any other way. You can't read about it and get as much about it as being there with the people and doing it.
And it was the Nebraska primary, I believe, where Senator Church was expected
to
speak
the
peanuts.
Well, he had actually accepted their major banquet, and Carter had not. And then Carter began to realize that his figures were going down, so he decided to surprise them and come, which made the people who were planning the banquet very, very mad. And Frank said, I've got to have some way to handle this. And we had a darling guy named Ira Dorfman and Carl Burke and a couple of people, and they decided the perfect thing was to get a basket of potatoes and Frank to present them to Jimmy Carter at the end of his speech and say, these are Idaho peanuts. And everybody just broke down all over the place. It was terrific.
Today we're presenting a special edition of our interview with Bethine Church, author of the memoir, A Lifelong Affair, My Passion for People in Politics. Bethine was the wife of the late Idaho Senator Frank Church. She died in December at the age of 90. How did Frank Church work with Jimmy Carter once he became president?
Well, it was a very strained thing. He was the only one who'd beaten him. They tried to make a rapprochement, but Carter's people, I think, were still upset that we had won those primaries. And as a result, it was tough. For example, the thing I remember is that he wouldn't ask him about foreign policy things. And Frank really wanted to help. And when he went out and gave that awful toast to the Shah of Iran, I can remember distinctly, I heard him laughing the next morning, which was New Year's Day, in the kitchen making coffee and laughing. And I said, what happened? And he said, well, I guess neither the ambassador, Helms, nor anyone had told President Carter that the ship was sinking, the water had hit the second deck, and the rats had already left. And that toast, unfortunately, helped make the bad feeling that caused all the problem. Frank had some Iranian friends who knew about Khomeini and knew exactly where everything sat. And he felt really awful about it.
Tell me about life after 1980. Not so much the campaign or the election which defeated Frank Church, but life after that, how did he adjust to no longer being in public life?
Well, there's a picture in the book that is the morning after we lost. And we're both standing there laughing like idiots. And we'd finally gotten everybody behind us to laugh. Everybody was in tears, all of our supporters. And this very nice young woman who was a reporter said to Frank in a very sort of dismal tone, Senator, did you and Bethine decide what you were going to do last night after the loss? And Frank paused for a long moment. He was very good with pregnant silences. And he said, oh, yes, we're going to stay together. And so everybody who knew us just broke them up in laughter. So it was good. And we had a wonderful 4 years. Frank wasn't very well. But he did the kind of speeches he wanted to do. He went the kind of places he wanted to go. He worked with a law firm that sent him abroad. And we found that other countries always thought that we had shadow governments. Everybody always expected him to be back in whenever the Democrats went back in. So we were treated just as we had been treated when we traveled on senatorial trips. So it was wonderful. Then also he made some money. And as he said, up till then, he'd never gotten rich at the public trough, so he needed it. He never voted for pay raises because he said, we still make more than most people in Idaho. Mm-hmm. And that's why he felt that way.
And even to the very end, he was devoted to some causes. I believe he managed to write in his last days an article that appeared in the New York Times on Latin America.
It was in the Washington Post. It was a huge op-ed on, on Latin America. Mm-hmm. And he struggled to write it. He also struggled to put some last questions on tape for Rod Grammer, who was writing the book Fighting the Odds with Leroy Ashby about Frank. And he picked out where he wanted to be buried, at Morris Hill Cemetery. He picked the spot because it was triangular and like Boris. And George Klein, who was out with us helping me while Frank was so sick in those 3 months, George said, but Senator, it's right near a restroom. And Frank said, George, don't worry about it. More people will come to visit me.
That's great.
He had a sense of humor right up to the very end. And Ted Kennedy and Claiborne Pell and and George McGovern all came to visit him, and all our old friends came, and our friends from Idaho came to help me, and he was home 3 months dying. He had said he always wanted to die like Adlai Stevenson, just dropping dead. But he said it was worth it to know as many people cared about him.
Well, you happened to name, and I know that there are many others, but you happened to name three Democrat senators who you referred to there who came to visit him. But in the end of the book, you also told a very touching story of Senator Alan Simpson, who was apparently in New York and not even aware of where Senator Frank Church was. And he got into a cab, and a cab driver who happened to be from Idaho.
It was wonderful. Yeah, the cab driver's from Idaho, and he said, "You sound like a Westerner." And he said, "Yes, I'm a senator from Wyoming." And so Alan Simpson said, "Well, I was just going to go to a reception, but you take me to where your senator is." And he said, "Well, he's at Sloan Kettering." And he came to visit him and told him what a good senator he was. And it really, really cheered Frank immeasurably.
Well, there's 326 pages or something in this book, and we've hardly had a chance to touch on all of the stories. Before we do close, any thoughts on how politics has changed since your direct involvement, or perhaps how the Democratic Party has changed over the years? When you look at the way you and your husband were involved in politics in the 60s and the 70s and the 80s, and then look at what's going on today, anything jump out at you?
Oh, well, there's a major jump out. Do you realize that when we first ran, Frank was not known? And we ran for 9 months on $6,000 that we had in our house. We sold our house, moved in with Pop and Mom. Mom came up with a little extra money. And then after Frank got into the general election, we were helped by the committee for a livable world and several other committees which helped. But we only spent, running against a sitting senator, around $49,000. Well, now it's in the millions. And it makes young people really despair of listening to people. These sound bites don't do what a full-scale meeting. Frank used to give a full-scale speech to 7 and 8 people because he said then they'll go out and take it to others. And, you know, this is important. And TV wasn't that expensive then. It makes such a difference. I think politics probably always has had its deadly aspects, like when the first three Clarks ran and they said, "Clark, Clark, Clarks," and the little red hen had tried to say something bad about each of them, and my mother was madder than a wet hen. But, you know, it's sad. It's sad the levels to which things go. And when people are told they're unpatriotic because they doubt their government or something their government's doing, I feel like Arthur Schlesinger speaking at Whitman for the commencement. I feel that the most important thing you can do as a citizen is be informed. And if you don't like what the government's doing, try to correct them. Don't hate them, but try to correct them. And if you like what they're doing, then support them. You know, I just think being a citizen of a free country makes you have to vote. I have never, ever given up my chance to vote or be involved. And somebody asked me just today over the phone, "How do you feel always being a Democrat in this state?" And I said, "I feel fine."
Well, you quoted your grandmother at the very end of the book, who said, "To whom much is given, much is required." It certainly seems to me that Bethine Church, who I'm sure would say too much has been given, you have also had much required of you, and you've delivered on that requirement.
I certainly have tried.
Well, you've done a wonderful job. We all owe you a debt of gratitude for the book, A Lifelong Affair, My Passion for People and Politics. Bethine Church, thank you for being with me today.
Well, thank you. I have really wanted to meet you, and I'm so pleased. And you obviously read the book so well.
I hope you enjoyed this special edition of our interview with Bethine Church. Next week, Jeffrey Wilhelm, author of Reading Unbound, Why Kids Need to Read What They Want and Why We Should Let Them. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones, research by Kathleen Tuck. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.